Today's episode is sponsored by John Paul the Great Catholic University at Escondido, California. St. John Paul II had a deep appreciation for the arts, and you may know that he was even an actor and a writer himself. He understood how influential storytelling and art can be on our culture, really having the power to move people's hearts towards God. Inspired by this call, John Paul the Great Catholic University is forming the next generation of creative professionals who will be bringing truth, beauty, and goodness to the entertainment industry. People who enroll can study film production, acting, animation, screenwriting, music design, and even video games. If you want to foster your God-given creative talents within a supportive and faithfully Catholic environment, we encourage you to explore JP Catholic's program and scholarships. JP Catholic is offering our listeners a full application fee waiver, which you'll find at jpcatholic.edu/herald. Pursue excellence in your creative craft without sacrificing your values. Visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. Perhaps you're not actually looking for a degree, but instead you want to sharpen your storytelling skills. JP Catholic also offers free online courses, such as a crash course in storytelling. Learn screenwriting from Christians who work in the industry. Whether you're interested in a full degree or free online classes, visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. That's jpcatholic.edu/herald, as in H-E-R-A-L-D. Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The problem we face about deciding when life begins and on what grounds it might be terminated in the womb, and how life should end and on what grounds it might be terminated early, beset our culture. Dr. Callum Midder, graduated from the University of Oxford Medical School and works as a doctor in the UK. He was a researcher at Oxford and published over 30 academic papers in medicine, law, philosophy and ethics, and also holds a degree in biblical studies at postgraduate level. He's given over 40 academic presentations internationally, and he's just the right person to help us give some further attention to the ethics of life and death from a Christian point of view. And he joins me now. Callum, thank you so much for joining me this morning, especially as we both had to get up early to do this. So if I look slightly shell-shocked and bleary, that's partly we're doing this at an unearthly time in the beginning of the day. You've developed quite a prominent persona in terms of your work particularly with abortion. And at the moment, we're discussing the pressing question of the way in which euthanasia legislation is being put before Parliament and developing fast as we talk about it. Can you just give me a little bit about your own background, both in terms of your religious affiliation and how it is as a doctor you found yourself at one of the most uncomfortable edges of public health policy? I mean, if I was at the beginning of a career as a doctor, I think the one place I wouldn't want to be is advocating conservative ethical views on abortion and euthanasia. They're not the soup du jour of the NHS culture.
Yeah, I never really anticipated it. I grew up in a very liberal kind of Christian background, so never thought about these questions, never was taught that they were bad things or anything like that. And really during medical school, I came to see the reality of abortion first, and the impact on women, the impact on the child, what it involved. And I, you know, clearly knew from first year of medical school that this was a human being. And so over that time, it took a few years, but gradually became convinced of a kind of orthodox position on that. And then euthanasia, likewise. To be honest, I don't even know how I ended up against that. I just kind of thought through the arguments, read a lot, and it seemed, again, compelling to me that it was a really bad idea. And so, I grew up very much with the standard kind of English views, you know, autonomy, liberalism, etc., and came to see that these were ultimately just harmful. And then, of course, I do have a Christian faith as well, which kind of reinforced that. But it was primarily, I think, the secular arguments that persuaded me first and foremost. And so I've always been a bit of a contrarian. I invite controversy a little bit. And I know that's not always a good thing. So I try not to to own that too much or to do it too much. But nevertheless, you know, I'm happy to make a scene which can be used for bad things. I got into a lot of trouble at school for things that were less honorable, but fortunately God has been able to use them for some more profitable things over time. And so, yeah, I think it's a double-edged sword in my personality, but something that ultimately has been helpful when there are hard truths that need to be said, but not always people willing to say them. And so obviously I try to do that seasoned with grace and compassion, because both of these involve areas where other people are involved other than the victim. And often those other people are in very vulnerable situations or in a lot of distress or suffering. And Christians, I think, have a duty not just to ignore that and to assert principle without caring, but to really respond to a person with the truth. And that requires grace and compassion. So I haven't always done that successfully either, but at least try to. And so ended up speaking a lot really unexpectedly, but something that I've just been launched into, and some people have wanted to listen, which has been very generous of them.
Well, I don't want to turn this into a therapy session, though we easily could, but I've also been called a contrarian and pedantic. So I'm going to bring those two things together for the moment. You see, I don't think we are contrarians. I think we're just inquisitive. And the problem with being inquisitive is you very badly need to find the answer to something. And if you're reasonably, I'm trying to avoid the word intellectual, but if you're reasonably inquisitive and prepared to persist with it, it seems to me you end up by disturbing other people who are less inquisitive and for whom the answers to many of the conundrums we're surrounded by don't matter very much. But I find that they matter enormously. And as I try and work my way to the end of it, people get uncomfortable and then they call me a contrarian to shut me up. But I think a contrarian is somebody who takes who takes a contrary view just in order to have an argument or to be attention-seeking or because their lives are boring. But I don't think, I'm sure you're not a contrarian and I'm not either, but isn't this part of the labeling that takes place to shut us up so that we will perhaps, you know, give up asking the difficult questions? Because the kind of things you and I are going to discuss in a moment are profoundly difficult. Because if, as we pursue the sometimes semi-complex or hidden ethics that lie at the heart of them, they require a change of behavior that's uncomfortable. And I think that's partly why this debate is closed down by people we live amongst professionally. Isn't that more the case?
I think, I certainly think that's true. I probably should be honest and say I think I am a contrarian by nature, but I don't mean to glorify that. and so it's not so much that I'm proposing it or being a contrarian now. It's more to say that that part of my nature, I think, has prepared me providentially for hopefully disagreeing in a more productive and truthful way, which is what I hope to do now and try to do now, which is not just have an argument for the sake of it, as you say, but to assert the truth, which can be disturbing and uncomfortable. And I think that's very clearly the case in, you know, issues like abortion, where I remember the Supreme Court in the US, when they were making one of their big decisions a couple of decades ago, they just said something like, you know, society has been based on this. It's just such a fundamental part of the fabric of society that it's sort of, we're dependent on it as a society. In that sense, it was kind of like the slave trade, where, you know, it's easy for us thinking back to say, well, you know, we can do well without slaves now. How hard could it have been? You know, this is just a sort of added luxury that happened to be deeply dehumanizing and horrible. But at the time, it was seen as absolutely essential to society. And the same is true of abortion now. Fortunately, not euthanasia yet, though I imagine if it becomes legal, it will be seen that way. And so absolutely, when something that is so integral to the economy of society is threatened, then I think it makes a lot of people fearful, some for, you know, understandable reasons if they're in a acute situation of distress, but others for much more, you know, perverse and chronic reasons, like the money that's made from it or sort of cult of the sexual revolution that it holds up, that people profit from in a number of different ways. So I obviously don't think we should take contrary positions for the sake of it. I did that in the past, hopefully don't do that so much now. But obviously we'd summarize it by saying we don't speak in order to offend, but we speak the truth, and if it offends, then so be it.
I'm very fond of the Monty Python paying for an argument sketch, which I think comes as close to identifying what a contrarian would like to do. But anyway, if you want to own it, that's absolutely fine. The fact that you insist on owning it when I'm refusing it suggests you really are a contrarian. And I'm perfectly happy to go with that. But as you quite rightly say, it can be used for good. I'd like to ask a bit about, I want to call it philosophy of life issues. I'm perpetually irritated by people making a distinction between the religious and the secular mind, because I think it's a false distinction imposed upon us by secularists who want to dismiss religious ethics as a category of philosophical incompetence. Whereas my view is that everybody has a philosophy of life and it's on a spectrum of some kind. There are clearly divisions where this spectrum changes as you move from believing in God and therefore being accountable to God and not. But essentially, it seems to me that we all have philosophies of life. It's just that people who have a faith are more explicit about it. One of the things that I've enjoyed about moving into the Catholic community and becoming a Catholic is the assumption that almost doesn't require any further examination about the sanctity of life. When I was a Protestant, I found myself having to argue that much more. In the way that you've described it, a lot of my fellow conservative Anglicans had all the right instincts about abortion and euthanasia, but on the whole were a little bit less confident in expressing them, because they couldn't be sure that everybody else agreed on the kind of the epistemological priority that, well, life was sacred, obviously. How did you come at the sacredness of life as a conservative Protestant when, you know, this isn't, in a sense, it's a conclusion you have to come for yourself? Was it your experience of being a doctor or some other sort of element in your thinking that brought you there so with such clarity?
Yeah, I don't think it really had a huge amount to do with my faith, which has also changed substantially over time, and probably even when I became pro-life was still kind of in the middle of a revision from very liberal Protestantism to conservative evangelicalism. I don't think that had a huge amount to do it. But of course, I think Christianity clearly does teach a particular position on the value of life. You're absolutely right. It's really a shame that in Western Europe, especially, there's just such lack of clarity on some of these issues. And I think it's a vicious circle, and that's the problem. You have people that don't teach about it in church, which means that the congregants don't know what to think. And so some of those congregants go on to be teachers and leaders, and they don't know what to think, and they've never heard it spoken about in a convincing or attractive way. And so the only model they have for engaging on these issues is this sort of caricaturistic straw man of, you know, the only way you can talk about abortion is going outside a clinic and screaming murderer at women going in. Which obviously almost never happens in reality. Sometimes, in, you know, rare cases it does, but it's, you know, I've virtually never heard pro-lifers do things like that. But because it's just never spoken about, that's the only model that people see or imagine. And so there's a vicious circle where it just reinforces and the silence just builds up and gets worse over the decades. And so I certainly think that's happened in Western Europe. I don't think it's the case in other parts of the world. I think in Latin America, in sub-Saharan Africa and various other places, the Protestants are just as clear about this issue as Catholics, you know, in the Vatican, so, which might not be saying too much in some cases.
In theory, Catholics are clear, but in practice, I think the same inhibitions exist. I remember, I think your point about the fact that people, clergy, are very hesitant to say anything is very well made. And one of the reasons is pastorally, well, what if I say something really quite difficult about abortion, knowing perfectly well that there's a large proportion of the women in this congregation
who'll have had one. I discovered quite how exciting it could be as a topic when I was once, I tend to avoid talking about this, but I'm going to make an exception now because it was an interesting occasion. So part of being part of the Royal Ecclesiastical Household means you go to preach at the Court of St. James once a year. That's what royal chaplains do. And so it was my gig in St. James's Palace Chapel. And I said to the senior chaplain who was there, you know, how exciting a sermon would you like this morning? And he said, it's been very dull here recently. Please be as exciting as you like. So I then began to talk about, because the text lent itself to it, I began to talk about abortion. Now, as it happens, people don't know this, but the chapel at St. James attracts ambassadors, ladies in waiting, but also some tourists can get in if they know the right people. And there were 24 American women tourists there. And as I, halfway through my sermon, they all got up, stood up and walked out. And so it was an exciting sermon. And I was both surprised and not surprised. I mean, obviously, I was not surprised because you know perfectly well it's a profound taboo to discuss it in any circle at all. And as it happens, whereas I don't think in a Catholic church people would walk out, though they might, this international gathering they certainly were. And I think that gave me a sense of how difficult it must be, particularly within Protestant churches where there isn't any kind of magisterium. And as you quite rightly say, you really ought to make your way there by faith and by intelligence and by reading the Bible. But there's no collective sense it's okay to say that because everyone agrees. Everyone doesn't agree. So so you came to it by simply a matter of praying, thinking, reading and medical experience.
Yeah, and I suppose it was mostly reading. I'm a very academic person by nature, still do a lot of academic work and research. And it was really it sort of derived ultimately from my more kind of left-wing beliefs, I guess. I just have had such, I mean, this is not a left-wing belief, it's very much a Christian belief, but it derived very much from my concern for the vulnerable and from my commitment to human equality. I said, look, if we really believe in human equality, then we have to believe in human equality, regardless of how inconvenient that might be or how unpopular that might be. And if science shows that this is a human being, not a potential human being, but an actual human being from the moment of fertilization, which science clearly did show, it's what we were taught in medical school, then we have to believe that this is equal and has the same rights and requires the same protection as anyone else. And so it was a very simple argument in the end. And I think part of the job of philosophers is to make complex what is actually quite simple and to obscure it. but really the argument itself is very obvious and very simple, and you have to do a lot of gymnastics to get around it. And so ultimately it was just a commitment to human equality and a real desire to protect vulnerable people on the margins that led me to this. Perhaps in the same way that, you know, with the euthanasia debate, which we'll get onto a little bit, it wasn't just the sort of conservatives who voted against it, but also the far left socialists. Because they had the clarity of thought in this case to realize that a lot of really vulnerable, marginalized people would be harmed by a euthanasia law. I wish that they had the same clarity when it came to abortion, but certainly I don't think it's necessarily, you know, out of grasp for people who are, you know, on the far left politically. And so, yeah, I came to it mostly through those arguments, and glad that I did come to that conclusion.
Well, congratulations. It took me much later in life to come there. And the reason I didn't come to it was because I hadn't thought about it and society discouraged any thinking about it. For me, it was the scale of the numbers. I was hosting a BBC radio show and somebody phoned in to complain about abortion. And I got rather bored and began to Google the numbers. And when I discovered at this particular juncture, they were 6 million. 6 million is a very particular resident number in the recent history of Western Europe. And I said, oh my goodness, that's a Holocaust. And very nearly got sacked on the spot by the BBC controllers. But as I then began to think about it, it was perfectly obvious that none of the liberals had any definition of when life began beyond conception. I mean, there just isn't any agreed point. And so medically, scientifically, philosophically, it's a no-brainer, but you're not allowed to say that. I'd like you to talk a little bit about some of the things you've been saying about the mental health of women who've tragically suffered or chosen abortions, because, as you quite rightly say in your presentations, the legislation upon which the abortion takes place is founded as notionally being there to protect the mother from danger to her mental health by having a child. And you make the point, which is too seldom made in the public space, that actually the reality is exactly the opposite. It's the procuring of abortion that creates an epidemic of mental health. Once again, this is something you're not allowed to say. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that people can take confidence in is that I would not say this if it were not really significantly backed up by the evidence, because I could get into a lot of trouble and lose my medical license. And so I'm very confident that the evidence clearly points in this direction, which is that abortion is harmful for a woman's mental health. The best evidence was summarized about 10 years ago by a pro-choice researcher from New Zealand. He's widely agreed to be the best researcher on this topic in the world. Sadly passed away a few years ago. But he was pro-choice. He said abortion is a woman's right. It should be legal. But we have to be honest about the scientific evidence. And he said, at the present time, there is no credible scientific evidence that abortion has mental health benefits. In fact, he found that if a woman has an abortion, she has a 30% increased risk of anxiety, a 70% increased risk of suicidal behavior, a 130% increase in alcohol abuse, and a 300% increase in drug abuse. And these are women who otherwise are, similar. They have the same mental health background, they have the same unwanted pregnancy, and so on. And so the evidence points in that direction. And as you say, in the UK, we technically don't have abortion on demand. We have abortion for mental health reasons and a couple of other reasons. But if you look at the statistics, 98% of them are done for mental health reasons, where the doctor is effectively saying, continuing this pregnancy would cause huge mental health problems. Having an abortion would be much less risky. And so the abortion is justified for health reasons. As you say, that's led to about 6 million abortions, maybe 7 by now, over the last 50 or 60 years. And a huge number of women who are much more damaged by it. And so it's of course, backfired completely, because we know that, the world is made not necessarily in a zero-sum game where one person benefits, to the detriment of another person in every case. In some cases, there are some things that are just bad for society because we were made in community. We were made to be functioning together so that when one person flourishes, other people flourish. When one person suffers, other people suffer. And that's certainly what we've seen in the case of abortion, that when the baby is hurt, the mother hurts as well, and the family and the society hurt. And therefore, being pro-life is not only about protecting the baby, which is, of course, tremendously important, but is about protecting all of them and supporting all of them. And that's what the Christian tradition has tried to do for, as many centuries as it has been around.
It is also the case that that there are consequences for that attach themselves to this epidemic of mental ill health. I don't know what the proportion of women who've had an abortion is. Do you have the figure? It's probably a figure you've got access to.
Yeah, we estimate that around 1 in 3 women in their lifetimes in the UK has an abortion. So it's extremely common, and goes back to what you were saying earlier, that, if you preach on it, it's very likely that there's someone within the church listening. If there's a, reasonable sized congregation, it's actually pretty likely that someone there has had an abortion or will have an abortion. So it's a very, very common thing, and we can see why people are a little bit tentative about it.
And it's extremely hard to talk about it without making without intensifying feelings of guilt that already, as you quite rightly say, exist. But presumably medically, if 30% or so of women have suffered an abortion, with one of the many attending consequences in terms of the illness of health, then we have an epidemic of mental illness, which has other effects, obviously, in terms of drug abuse, you said, but presumably then also adds to the burden of the NHS and makes it much more, the whole business of public health becomes compromised as well as a knock-on effect, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I had a debate with a leading abortion sort of proponent recently, and they said, Well, if abortion causes these mental health problems and one in three women has an abortion, shouldn't we expect to see an epidemic of mental health problems? And it was a little bit bewildering because that's exactly what this country has. And it's the thing we talk about every week on the news. And so certainly I think they're connected. And of course, mental health problems, as you say, not only have cause a burden on the NHS, you know, psychiatry waiting times are goodness knows how long, but also they cause intergenerational problems. They cause intragenerational problems. They cause society-wide problems. It's really something that ripples throughout society and causes, you know, immense difficulty. A lot of people say, you know, we don't want to, as you say, stir up those feelings of guilt or make people feel worse. But the reality is these feelings are there anyway. So the only options we have are not to avoid any pain or difficulty at all, because it's already there. The only two options we have are we can leave this silent and leave people to fester in their own distress and mental health problems and guilt and shame, or we can speak about it in a way that brings life and brings hope and healing. And that's far better. And so one of the helpful things I've heard for church leaders and pastors and priests especially is that, you know, for church leaders, they will say from the front every week, no matter what you've done, whether you've killed someone or had sex before marriage or stolen something or lied to God or whatever it might be, you can be forgiven. But if they never say that you can be forgiven for having an abortion or for paying for an abortion or for driving your girlfriend to get an abortion, it sort of tacitly communicates the message that this is the unforgivable sin. Yeah. If you say that every other sin explicitly is forgivable, but you never mention abortion, what people feel is this is not forgivable. And there's actually survey evidence in America to back this up, that a significant proportion of women in the church say that God's teaching, the church's teaching on forgiveness and the gospel does not apply to abortion. And that's a horrifying thought, that in our silence, we are leaving a significant percentage of women in this situation and men in this situation who have been part of it to actually believe that the gospel doesn't apply to them. And that's what silence actually does. It doesn't ease the conscience. It doesn't ease the soul. It actually puts it in far more jeopardy and distress.
Yeah, that's very well expressed. Thank you for doing it. I mean, I was beginning to realize, working my way through the implications slowly, and seeing more clearly than I have done before that the church is engaged in a conspiracy of silence on the matter. I mean, you know, as I, from my short, my anecdote a moment ago, I tried to do something about that in particular circumstances, but more as a reflex to the situation rather than a developed conviction that this was the right thing to do as a matter, if you like, of public Christian policy. But I think a lot of people will be surprised at what essentially, let's not call it an accusation, let's call it a diagnosis. The diagnosis that the church is involved in this conspiracy of silence that, first of all, leaves the matter untouched. But as you quite rightly say, and again, this will be surprising to some people, suggests that abortion is the one unforgivable sin, you know, the sin against the Holy Spirit. My reading of the scriptures is that the unforgivable sin is calling evil good and good evil, because once you've done that, you lose capacity to repent because you've changed the terms of reference. And so repentance is absolutely essential to forgiveness. And if you can't, you know, then de facto it becomes the unforgivable sin. But to replace that with abortion is doubly problematic, because first of all, you distract from what the unforgivable sin is, but at the same time, you then lock women into this dreadful place of guilt. So thank you for expressing it so clearly. Let me take you to euthanasia, because one of the things that I found myself doing in the public space is saying time and time again to liberal bien-pensant commentators that we've already been through the arguments about slippage and the slippery slope when it comes to framing legislation that protects people from implicit abuse of the legislative process. So for euthanasia, everyone is saying, well, once we've agreed we're going to do it, don't you Christians or you conservatives come at us and say, we can't frame legislation making it safe in the terms we've agreed. You may not agree in principle, But here we are. Nonetheless, it's going to happen. It's a fact of life. And we can promise you your second argument doesn't apply. We will frame laws that stop it being abused. To anybody who's looked at the whole abortion industry, that's laughably stupid.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we've seen how the abortion debate has played out. I can't remember the verbatim quotes, but, you know, back in the, I guess, late 80s, early 90s, when abortion was being expanded and a disability clause was being added in that you could have abortions for disabilities and so on, the argument was made by some leading Oxbridge law scholars that this would lead to abortion for pretty much any disability because of the way that the abortion law was worded. And people said, you know, I think Harriet Harman said that they should be disqualified from the Bar Society and things like that because of their scaremongering. Other people said very explicitly, this is only for people with life, only for fetuses or babies with life-limiting conditions that are simply not able to live outside of the womb. And what we now see is 90% of babies with Down syndrome are aborted. You can have an abortion for a cleft lip or a cleft palate. Intersex conditions you can have an abortion for, and many, many other much more trivial conditions. Likewise with the mental health clause, you know, they said this is just going to be a limited number of abortions where the woman really is going to have a significant health problem because of her pregnancy. And traditionally that was thought to be rape. We actually don't have a clause in our law that says you can have an abortion in cases of rape, because that's basically what the mental health clause was there to do. It was there to say, if you're that distressed because you've been the victim of sexual violence and, you know, you simply cannot tolerate the idea of keeping this baby when you've been in that situation, then you can have an abortion. The reality on the ground is, if you go to certain doctors and say, I don't want a baby girl, I want a baby boy, then they can ask you, well, do you think that having a baby girl would affect you emotionally? And if you say yes, then that counts as a mental health reason and you can have an abortion. Now, not every doctor will do that, but some will. And the main abortion providers like BPAS say very explicitly that the only reason that they will not do an abortion is for that reason. So they say any reason counts other than the sex of the baby, which means that, you know, it's effectively abortion on demand. And then some doctors will go even further and do it even just for the sex of the baby. And so absolutely, we've seen this very, very clearly in abortion. And I think we'll see the exact same on euthanasia.
Presumably this sex of the baby exception is a tipping of the hat to feminism on the grounds that feminists have always been outraged that in other cultures, in inverted commas, there's been a preference for male children, and so girls have either been killed at birth or in other ways discriminated against. So I'm imagining this is a feminist taboo, but what you're saying is that how, whatever the strength of feminist taboos, and there are many others in our society, even this one is giving way. Outside BPAS, the people are saying, well, that's fine. Same, you know, sex selection, as you quite rightly say, counts as a matter of causing distress. And so it qualifies, which is again, quite extraordinary in terms of the way in which the target has moved during the debate since it began.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think it's very much just a PR move rather than anything else. The law clearly doesn't separate this big distinction between every other reason for an abortion and sex selective abortion. It's really just a recognition that it looks bad for them in the public if they say they do sex selective abortions, and it makes them look unfeminist. And so they say they won't do it. Now, probably, you know, we know outside of BPAS they do it. I imagine it's plausible that even some within BPAS will do it, even though the organization would deny it. And so, yeah, we've seen it time and time again. The euthanasia slippery slope we've seen in other countries, you know, everywhere else it's gradually eroded. They've said initially we have very strict safeguards. It's only going to be for adults. It's only going to be with their consent. It's only going to be if they have a terminal illness with 6 months left to live. And so on. You know, you have to get a psychiatric evaluation, you have to get two doctors to sign it off, and so on. And everywhere else, we see these constantly eroded. In Belgium, we see children being euthanized. In the Netherlands, we see newborn babies being euthanized if they have disabilities. The Netherlands, we also see a lot of non-consensual euthanasia. So adults who are ill, sometimes not even ill, but who are involuntarily euthanized, i.e. literally murdered by their doctors. In Belgium, they've started using them for organ harvesting. And there's even papers looking at how many organs we could get through Belgium's euthanasia program. And this is a genuine discussion that people are having in the academic sphere, is what is the scope for organ harvesting from Belgium's euthanasia program? So all of these things that, you know, once you cross the Rubicon, as it were, everything becomes possible, and the safeguards inevitably look arbitrary and discriminatory. You know, if we say that if you can end your life because it's your choice over your life, you deserve the autonomy over how you end your life and when you end your life. And if someone is in unbearable suffering, then we just have to end their life as a remedy to that. Well, then why do you limit it to people with only 6 months left to live? If there's someone with 10 years of suffering left to live, the case seems even more compelling that we should let them end their lives. And so ultimately, the slippery slope works not only because of political forces and so on, but because it's the inherent logic of these issues, that if autonomy is paramount and that if the prevention of suffering by any means at all is paramount, then we simply cannot have any safeguards or limitations, because it would discriminate and because it would be, you know, unfair to those people that didn't have access to it.
I'm so glad you've articulated that way. I'm feeling a bit stupid. I was interviewed on LBC by Rachel Johnson, who's otherwise a very nice woman, but she was insistent on saying you're being completely unreasonable, because you know, it only applies to people who've been given a diagnosis of death within 6 months. I mean, the best I could do was to say, well, diagnoses of death within 6 months are notoriously unreliable, but it hadn't occurred to me, as it now has, and I hope it'll occur to other people too, that, as you quite rightly say, if it's about suffering within 6 months, and in fact you're not going to die in 6 months, you're going to die in 6 years, it simply strengthens the case, because it lengthens and intensifies the period of suffering. And if on some Benthamite principle, which is one imagines what lies behind this, we're talking about the increase of suffering and euthanasia being a palliative tool to stop it happening, then, as you say, it just strengthens the argument to make it a longer period. And I'm embarrassed I didn't see that earlier on. I've seen it now, and I'll bring it up. Tell me, what do you think? What do you think is going to happen to legislation? I've been surprised at the extent to which people have woken up and begun to discuss this, and people who weren't automatically our friends philosophically have suddenly begun to be alert about the realities of the human condition. It always seems to me it's kind of Rousseau versus the Garden of Eden. We're surrounded by liberals who are absolutely convinced there's nothing wrong with humanity, despite the history of the 20th century, and there's nothing wrong that a bit of tax and education and leisure can't improve. But slowly but surely you see eyebrows being raised at the implications, particularly the way in which the goalposts have been moved in other areas like Canada and the Netherlands. Do you think that before the final reading of the bill, there'll be sufficient clarity to actually stop it happening? Or are we faced, as I suspect we are, by a philosophical steamroller that the left has committed itself to seize an opportunity to drive through the legislative process, and nothing is going to be allowed to stop it?
I think we certainly have an uphill battle, but not a foregone conclusion. So we need to swing about 28 members of parliament from their first vote to the final vote, which is, you know, a fairly small percentage of parliament, but a significant number to completely swing in the opposite direction. There are some MPs who didn't vote at all, who also could potentially vote against. And the initial indications showed that it is possible, because a significant number of MPs said that they're not voting for it because they definitely agree. But in order to keep the debate going and to have a committee and a report and to actually consider the issue fully rather than shutting it down without a debate, because, you know, this whole topic has had about 5 hours debate in Parliament. I think there was a statistic that they debated for 700 hours or something over fox hunting. And yet to introduce this, it could happen with just 5 hours of parliamentary debate and then a bit more at the third reading. And so they're absolutely right that there has been minimal scrutiny, minimal conversation about this, and it would be reckless even from that perspective to push it through. But some MPs said that they voted for it just to keep that debate going, and so could potentially swing against it in the final vote. I think it's an uphill battle, though, so we have to really fight. I was pleasantly surprised by some quarters. As I mentioned, there's a sort of split among the left on this, with the sort of progressive sort of autonomy kind of idolizing left going for this, but then the socialist left and maybe even more the radical kind of far left being very much opposed to this, and in a pretty strong numbers. I think 40% of Labour voted against it or something like that. So a very strong representation against it in that camp. Pleasantly surprised also by the Conservative Party, 80% of whom voted against it. Of course, it should be 100%, especially from the Conservatives, but I say I'm pleasantly surprised only because I've seen the Conservative Party over the last 20 years, and I've come to expect nothing at all from them. So 80% against is relatively good for them. I would have liked to see better leadership from Kemi Badenoch, who said that she's in principle for it. So she's certainly not an ally. She's certainly not going to be offering any convincing leadership on the issue, and she hasn't done so far, and she won't in the future. But I was, as I say, I was pleasantly surprised by the majority of Tories, with a few exceptions, including Sunak. Disappointingly surprised by Reform, who I would have thought wanted to position themselves as a, and have positioned themselves as a genuinely conservative alternative. And as someone put it to me yesterday, they fell at the first hurdle because 3 out of their 5 MPs voted for it. Nigel Farage, to his credit, voted against and actually spoke quite well against it in the public. And I think realizes that he's losing a lot of his new followers, and he's losing a big, significant potential voting block and alienating a lot of donors and influential people by having so many of his party go for this. And so I think there's, you know, pressure can be applied to all of these parties, but particularly Reform. I think they are feeling the heat a little bit because they were supposed to be a bit more conservative. They were actually one of the most pro-euthanasia parties in the final votes. But I think they're beginning to recognize that, but I think they need a bit more kind of pushing in the right direction and pressure in order to really see the mistake that they've made. And so, yeah, I think that there is hope. It's an uphill battle, but I think there's a significant chance that we can win, and we should certainly be fighting for that. And certainly if people raise more awareness and get more involved, I think we have a chance.
I wasn't sure whether or not I should be politically astounded or theologically astounded at Reform's failure. The theological astonishment is, how is it possible that people who are not on the left can't see the implications of this? But the political astonishment was, as you quite rightly say, if you're setting yourself out to be a bastion of conserving value, and you can't see that conserving the life of human beings is one of the conserving values, then you don't deserve to be in the political game at all. And I was astonished. We've got to wrap up in a moment, but I'd like to ask you one last question. One of the astonishing developments has been astonishing and yet quite obvious and expectable is that doctors and nurses who don't want to practice abortion, begun by being given professional exceptions, inevitably ended up by having their careers jeopardized or terminated if they weren't prepared to do it. The same thing presumably is going to happen to euthanasia. If you're this, and not only is this a matter of professional potential termination, but it changes the whole way in which a doctor sees themselves as a doctor. I mean, the thought that, you know, whenever a doctor enters a room now, if you're a patient, you're perfectly entitled to think, well, they may be unsympathetic, they may not be as skilled as I want them to be, they may not do what I want them to do, but we are at least committed to the fact that we're both determined that I should get my position to be made better in some way or another. the thought that the doctor can now be your potential executioner, whilst dramatic, is well, it's an extraordinary reversal of role and association. Is this something that doctors themselves have become aware of, or is it something that's only going to become obvious in time?
Yeah, I think it's particularly frightening for people with suicidal tendencies or who have loved ones with suicidal tendencies, because, you know, not only is it sort of shifting the doctor from the role of, you know, healer to executioner, but it also shifts the psychiatrist's role or the doctor's role for people in those, you know, very vulnerable situations from, okay, whatever I don't have in this life, whatever risks I face, whatever sort of difficulty I find myself in, the doctor will be there wanting me to live, preventing me from committing suicide, and hopefully preventing me from that very dark, you know, outcome. And now you could go to the doctor and realize that they might actually think that it's the right decision, and they might even encourage you to do that in some cases. And so it's a horrifying, a very terrifying thought for many people with those vulnerabilities. Certainly it would change the medical profession. Some people have called it crossing a Rubicon, and I think it's a little bit misleading to say that. You know, we started this 60 years ago when we legalized the ending of life in the womb. And this is just the natural extension of that. So that was the crossing of the Rubicon. This is just the, you know, the end of the Republic and the coming of the empire in all its totality. And so I think there's been a bit of revisionism and a bit of kind of wishful thinking on the part of some pro-choice opponents of euthanasia, because I think they've actually already let this in the door 60 years ago, and it's much harder to resist it now that we've already broken that fundamental rule on not killing. But certainly it's another huge step in that direction. And certainly for, you know, born children and adults, it represents a very new threat to them, and a very acute threat. And so doctors certainly are realizing this. 90% of palliative care doctors are opposed to legalizing euthanasia. So it's an overwhelming consensus among palliative care doctors, who are the ones who know most about relieving suffering, about what a patient's experience is really like towards the end of their lives, and who also have the time and the expertise to go most into patients' social history and situation, to understand the coercion they might feel, to understand the pressure they might feel from their families, and all of those dynamics that most doctors, frankly, don't have the time to really go into. And so I think the fact that most palliative care doctors are very, very against this is a really strong signal, and a very worrying signal, that if this happens, it would be tremendously harmful. And so my hope is that they will continue to keep acting. The problem with doctors is, although that they have a lot of technical expertise, they're not always very good at politics, and they're not always very bold in doing what's right. There's a lot of kind of careerism. And so my hope is that this will be the one issue that makes them sit up and say, look, no matter what, we have to fight on this, even if it means losing our careers, because the threat to our patients is just that great. And so that's my hope for the medical profession over the next few months.
Dr. Callum Miller, on behalf of the vulnerable, but on behalf of us all, thank you very much.
Thank you.